military service, veterans, their families, and the impact. Project Unpack.
I think it's a good idea to getting some older people to talk about World War II and prior to that and that stuff, put all of this down on tape for people that are 100 years from now will all know what the hell happened to us people.
And, well, it's not just going down on tape. Project Unpack. This is Bill Thomas at Prairie Public. And on a beautiful day in North Dakota, I walked into a room in a senior living complex, and gradually a bunch of people gathered, like 10, 20, 25, mostly older men, some women, some younger. And this was all part of something called Project Unpack, which is a project about veterans and their families. And it's got some of the usual parts of such projects, like oral history recording and guest speakers coming in to talk about their books they wrote. But some parts of the project are a little different. And in this room today, we're going to find out how one of those unusual things works. So come on in with us. You'll hear a lot of people talking about a lot of different things. And here's Michael Strand of the art faculty at North Dakota State University explaining a little bit about what they're doing.
So these are the cups, and we actually see them as like heirlooms, like something that they're making, that they're connected to.
Now I have to break in and tell you a little bit what these cups look like. They are, well, a little bit like a vase or a chalice, maybe, but they're a cup, about maybe 16 ounces or so, you know, good size. And they're made out of this fine porcelain clay that is gray because it hasn't been fired yet. You know, they haven't put it in the kiln, so it's not hard. It's still soft, and you can push things into it and make marks in it. And they have a big plastic tub full of them with damp cloths over them to keep them soft.
They're functional as well. We like the idea of them being, and like the gentleman said, you know, I could see, and I'm really looking forward to using this to have a beer and kind of reminisce about my service. So the cup becomes this thing that's collaboratively made, and then it's gift. Then they get the cup back, and we really see it as. And I think they've expressed interest in this, of it being, you know, sort of handed down, becomes a family object. We'd like to get 20 cups from each kind of location like this, and if we had 60 to 70 of these objects in the end, I think that would be a real positive thing. Yeah.
And what characterize some of the different things that people have been doing with the cups?
Yeah, I mean, there's this a canteen that was his father's and his brother-in-law, and the canteen that they brought in, which actually they used to impress in the side of this cup, had two bullet holes that didn't strike him when he was in World War II. But they have this amazing artifact, and so they've used, and there's these entry and exit points of this canteen, so actually the clay receives that quite well, and it imprints it into the side of the cup. And so in the case of that, the cup becomes literally this sort of frozen, an accompanying artifact to the real thing. What we're going to do is, when we show things in an exhibition, for instance, it's really about their words, it's really about their stories. And it'll be the canteen and the object and their story. It will all be kind of combined together as a way to kind of present multiple ways of capturing that. We had a woman who came in earlier, and I think this is so, was the spouse of a World War II veteran, and she had two things that were really powerful. One is a radio, where this was his only accompaniment in a hospital for 22 months while recovering from a leg injury where he lost his leg. And so this radio, which is over here, is such an incredible object. But she also brought in his Purple Heart and his Bronze Star. And she wanted these were really precious objects, and she was willing to, and she wanted to, actually, she's the one who pulled them out and said, let's push these in the side. So then we have a Purple Heart cup and a Bronze Star cup. And she was delighted by that process, just seeing how that works and how this becomes something that she was saying she could pass down, and she's excited about that. So those are really two unique things. I like that in this case we had a relative of one who said, well, I'm looking forward to using this cup someday and remembering you. I think that's a pretty neat interchange.
Two people from the same family.
Same family, yeah. And so then they were here making together, and he said, this is because this reminds me of you, John, and because you made it. And I thought that was pretty great. And I think that's what as a project, and what we're excited about is that there's multiple ways that we communicate, and sometimes when you get something else in your hands and you're creating something, it unlocks further conversation, and that's the point of doing all these different kinds of ways of connecting with people.
Okay, maybe now's a good time where I need to explain a little more about Project Unpack. It's funded by the National Endowment for the Humanities, and it's out of North Dakota State University. Dr. Christina Weber in the Sociology Department pulled it together. She's working with Angela Smith, who works on oral histories, and Michael Strand, who we just heard from, and Josh Zeiss, who's a ceramic artist and a veteran. And what they're looking to do is unpack, help for veterans and family members to unpack or talk freely about life in the military and experience of war, returning home, readjusting to life as a civilian. You're going to hear some unpacking if you stick with us and listen for a while. They're doing a whole bunch of community events, book discussions, recording, archiving personal stories, and things like this ceramic cup clay workshop that I'm bringing you to today. So we hope that helps you understand better and learn some things about veterans and their families and what they experience. Now, did you hear him say that there was a woman who brought in a radio that was her husband's lifeline when he was in hospital for a long time, recuperating and doing rehab from having lost a leg? That really intrigued me. I'm a radio guy, you know. I had to go talk to her. And, well, she didn't just have this cool old wooden tube radio that I love the look of. She had a paper grocery bag full of stuff.
Yeah, I think what we might need, because what we have, I think, two people with physical artifacts, dog tags. This radio is incredible. That's a great, really great story on this radio. I think that'll be a really, I might have you work with her. Her mother, it's her father. How is this? Her grandfather. Her mother is bringing the dog tags down, and this was her.
Should I just take a picture?
So what do you got? Grocery bag. Tell me your name.
Hilda Warner.
Okay, and what have you got in there?
Oh, this is a picture of him.
And who is the picture of?
Sebastian, my husband that was...
And for an expert, I guess that's not really his
name. Yeah. This was... He was wounded in Italy. He lost his leg. That's where he was at McCluskey General Hospital in Texas. And that must have been one of his caretakers. Anyway, and this was a picture he took while he was still in the hospital, that he sent that to me.
I'm going to just wait a couple more minutes.
Yeah. Okay.
Because if people are kind of filtering in, then I'll get everybody started at once.
And
hi, how are you?
This was a pillow that he sent to his mother from Camp White, Oregon.
Oh, you brought many things.
Here's his
one nowhere.
His cap.
Oh, it has a little insignia.
And then here's his
oh my gosh.
His Purple Heart. His dog tags. And then this was a shell from the funeral when the seven-gun salute. That was a shell. And it's just his picture when he was young man.
Yeah, very handsome.
Yeah, he was 22 years old.
I wonder if that was 22. The hat, how he's wearing the hat sideways. Oh, is that cocky. His personality?
Yes. Absolutely.
Now, is this him?
Yes, that's right. Shortly after he, 22 months in a hospital.
And now tell me about this radio.
Well, when he was in traction for I don't know how many months he was in traction, you know, to get the skin back down over his stump. And he said he'd count the holes in the ceiling and count the drips of the bottles, the tubes. And he said that's what kept him sane, you know.
What he listened to?
Music, you know, he liked the music, yeah. And the funny thing was, when he found out that he lost his leg, he thought, I won't be able to dance anymore. But he proved that he could on one leg. Yeah, he was determined, yeah.
What kind of music did he like?
Oh, anything. He loved music no matter what. But at that time, it was the jive. In fact, he won a dance contest at the USO when they had a party for, you know, a dance, and he was competing, and he won the jitterbug contest on one leg. It was in the Fargo Forum. They sent a picture to the Fargo Forum. It was in 1945.
Did he like Glenn Miller and Tommy Dorsey and that kind of
yes,
stuff?
Yes, he loved that. He liked the jive. Yeah.
So.
Yeah. He'd be ready to come home, and then they found out that he had terrible scars in through his groin, and they wouldn't let him go until they could fit him with a prosthesis. So then he'd go back into the operating room. They'd have to dig deeper, you know.
Yeah.
And then finally, almost 2 years later, you know, he got his discharge.
Michael Strand comes over to Mrs. Wanner to explain the cup process.
To think about the artifacts that were part of that service, and then to kind of identify stories connected to those things. So your radio, for me, is so inspiring.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh.
Because it represents such a unique perspective of service, mm-hmm. you know, of sacrifice.
Right.
But it's the kind of the human, the like in the room with the radio, mm-hmm. 2 years of recovery. Those are all really intense things. So what we're doing is connecting with individuals. We're kind of, we have a couple of different ways to record that, mm-hmm. and write some things down.
Okay.
And then the other thing that we're doing is we're making these cups, because part of it is history, mm-hmm. part of it is recording, and it's part of it's writing, and then there's part of it that's connected to objects that we make.
Okay.
And so what we're doing, and I'll show you one.
Okay.
So this was from So this is from a gentleman who is a World War II veteran.
Okay.
And so what we're doing is it's porcelain and nothing gets affected by it.
Okay.
But this was one of his commendation awards, and this is just and what we're doing is creating what we think of as heirlooms.
Oh, sure.
And we're making these cups that then we make with people who come, and then you get the cup when you're done.
Oh,
and part of it is that then we think, you know, this is Mr. Starks, and he's saying then he's going to give it to his son, and then his son will give it to his grand, like a family heirloom.
Okay.
So we actually, like a dog tag is perfect.
Oh, yeah.
And it won't affect a dog tag, but we would like to sit down and if we could have maybe a 20 minutes or a little bit of time with you to talk more about these.
Yeah.
Okay. So, yeah. Bill is important. So Bill is here to help kind of document what we're doing as a project.
Uh-huh.
So we're doing it with Of course, current Afghanistan, Iraq veterans, Vietnam, and World War II and Korea, and family members are one of our really, you know, because you have these great stories. You know, this is particularly rich, and especially your connection and your mother's connection. You say your mother's?
No, his mother.
His mother, sorry.
Seb's mother.
Okay.
Yes, yeah, he sent it to his mother.
Okay.
And then I inherited it.
Okay. I got this. Okay.
Yeah, when he first went into the service, when he was stationed in Oregon.
Right.
Yeah, okay. And he sent his mother this pillow.
And your relationship, this was?
My husband.
Yeah, your husband. Okay, and I just didn't hear that in the beginning part.
It's my husband.
I didn't. Wow.
Yeah, we married after he came back.
After he was in service. And these are all the artifacts.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, I mean, so you have a particularly rich story.
I said I had a lot of prostheses up in the attic.
Sure.
If you didn't catch that, she said, attic full of prosthesis, artificial legs.
Wore out, and that, you know, just the improvement. And oh my gosh, if he could have had one like they have now, he couldn't have stopped him for anything.
Right. So I guess would you mind taking a seat over here, and I can show you
fine.
What we're doing, and
and
then we'll go from there.
Okay.
Okay. Awesome.
So Mrs. Warner goes over and sits with Michael Strand and Christina Weber. And a cup, firm enough to stand, but soft enough to take an impression.
This clay is like, it records, like in a way, it records any little tiny pressure. Like, I'll show you, my fingerprint is on there now. And so anything that we impress, that object becomes part of it, and it changes it. And we actually see it as yours, like you have made it. We just have a starting point, and then we'll work with you to kind of transform this. To turn it into something that becomes, awesome. Okay, so I'll give you, Josh, do you have your test one? Sorry to interrupt you.
This is it right here.
Okay, so this is a test. This isn't the one for real, but I'll just show you. So, and do you mind if I do something with this?
No, okay.
And again, it won't affect it.
Okay.
So if I take this, I press it in.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's really clear.
Really clear, yes.
And then what happens is when we fire it, it'll pick up every little texture. So let's say, I mean, that's a bullet.
Mm-hmm.
Do you mind if I take this and just take that off? And I will be very careful with anything here. So this, and this again is a test.
Planning as part of the task force with 7 other nations. So he represents 101st.
Wow. Just gets stamped right in the side. So suddenly, and here's what we like to think about as artists or as historians, that this object is going to last thousands of years, and so it really will hold up a test of time. And so what you put in here will be there to communicate to people in the future. I think that's kind of a remarkable thing about ceramics or art. So the first thing we can do is... I wanted to show you what we're going to do in the next phase. The first thing I think is that radio is so fascinating to me. And it's a very simple form. We asked for a name of the object. So the radio, you could call it radio, or you could call it, because it was connected to an experience, is there a way you could give it a title like hospital radio? Or what's the significance of this object to your family and to your service or your family member's service? And your story that you shared, even capturing that in a short paragraph, becomes really important. Like people then can read that as a quote.
Mm-hmm.
Does that sound good?
Yes.
Okay.
Christina Weber and Mrs. Warner, Hilda Warner, talk about how difficult it was to communicate with a boyfriend who was in a hospital in Italy, missing a leg in World War II.
And then you got letters and everything was blocked out, you know, censored.
They couldn't tell you where they were.
No,
They
got the telegram, you know, that he was seriously wounded. But that's all that they knew. Then, you know, no way to contact him or anything. You know, it just had to be so hard. So different. So different now, you know. Yeah, right. And see each other on the, you know, families can see. And,
Michael comes over to explain that they'd like to put some of the things in a public art exhibit at the Rourke Gallery. Mrs. Warner says she doesn't know where that is.
Oh, I'm not familiar with.
Oh, okay.
I came from Dickinson.
Oh, okay. Where we're showcasing stories and some of these objects, okay. And then some of the actual objects. Now it's a gallery museum, so they're an institution. Would you? And this is bold of me asking. Would you consider? I think the radio is so amazing. What we could do is we would display the radio and your cup.
Okay.
Because there's just so much, a lot of richness to that.
Yeah.
And then the story of the radio as part of the exhibition.
Sure.
And that would be wonderful.
Oh, sure.
That would be.
I'd be happy to do that.
Yeah. And I think it's one of those stories that when we think about an exhibition, they move through and there'll be heroic things. And there'll be these really, like, such a beautiful, like, in a way, the way you talked about it, it's such a beautiful human story, and a tragic one too, in that room for two 22 months. I think that seeing a radio as that one connection is powerful, and so I want to thank you for sharing that.
Well, I'm glad my daughter talked me into that.
Yeah.
She said, well, that was what he really, that's what kept him going, was that radio. So that was when you think about him laying there. Oh. And then we were writing letters too, you know, while he was in the hospital, and that kept him going too.
Oh, right. Yeah.
And then that picture, you know, I almost forgot what it looked like until he sent me that picture, you know.
So where did you know him from originally?
Well, his brother was married to my aunt, so I knew him. He came and worked for his brother, and I was helping out there too, so I had a crush on him before he left. And he didn't change a bit. I mean, to me, he was the same person as when he left, you know, whether he lost a leg or not, so... It was the same person.
So you lived a whole life with him. How did you feel like his experiences and losing a leg? I mean, how did you feel it affected him, or did it?
Oh, well, he accepted it so well, and he said, "He always said that's behind me." You know, he said, "You just go on." So, and he did He helped a lot of. You know, his nephew lost a leg, and then. He told him, he says, you can go on, you know, and just encourage them. And he was an inspiration.
Did it give him pain, or did it have joint problems?
A lot of pain. Oh, yes. Sometimes he couldn't wear the prosthesis. He'd be so sore, you know, that he couldn't.
We'll be back.
And then he had this one with a bar, iron bar up, you know, with a thick belt around the waist. You would get boils under that belt and sores and, you know, and stump. And then he fought to get a suction one, you know. And then it worked the opposite way. It pulled all the... First, they were going to cut off some more bone because, you know, it pushed the flesh up, you know, from, you know, that pressure. And he says, no way. He says, give me a suction, you know. And they did, and then it pulled the flesh back down again. It did work. And then it would crack open on the bottom, and he would have, it would drain and everything. He had a hard time. And sometimes he would just take it off and... just go on crutches. And then finally he couldn't wear it at all because his back gave out, you know, being without the, you know, because shifting his body all the time, walking, you know.
And
sometimes he'd get discouraged. But, you know, sometimes I would think, if I could only help him, you know, but in the morning he would get up and he'd put that stump into that leg, and then he would have to shift it, you know, get down into that. And I said, so often you think, you get up, you put on your shoes, and you get up and go. And this way, you know, to get that thing adjusted right so he could walk on it, that was hard.
Did you ever think about, you know, like how your family life would have been different if he hadn't lost a leg?
Well, we could have run. A lot of times I was wishing, you know, I could just run with him, you know, but It didn't. It wasn't that way, but
so
you just go on with what it is.
What work did he do?
He worked at the press, linotype operator and machinist. Yeah.
So he was on his feet.
Oh yes.
His foot.
Yeah, he went to work all the time. And then, well, when his back gave out, he couldn't do it anymore. So then he got disability. So then, but he worked for 17 years at the Dickinson Press. But he did what he could.
So were you both from Dickinson?
Yes. Well, he was from a little town. I don't know if you're familiar with Western North Dakota. New England.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. It was just, Sheffield was just a little village. You know, that's where he was from. And I was from, lived north of Belfield. You know, Belfield is on. Yeah.
I was sitting by.
Yeah, no, I'm glad she talked to you into bringing these things in.
Yeah, but it's been interesting.
So what did, since you knew him before he went in and everything, do you have any sense of, like, what did his parents think of him going in? And, you know, then when he lost a leg and all?
He was drafted. You know, he had no choice. Oh, he didn't want to leave. He was a farm boy. He would have loved to come back and be, you know, have a farm, but he couldn't do it, not with his leg. So he had it. And then a guy at the college talked him into going to Wahpeton, you know, to take up printing. And then he was there for 2 years, from 1949 till 1951. He graduated, and he worked at the press then. Yeah. So.
The TVY, worst temporary duty, and the Chinese communists were selling Kamoi and Matsu. And so we put a show of
We were married 57 years.
Yeah, Taiwan.
Right.
He died in 2002.
That's a while ago in a way, but in a way it's not that long.
15 years. But it seems like yesterday. Yeah, just, but we had five daughters.
So one thing we can do. Is that we can put your last name on here.
All right, well, thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome.
He's upright. That's Hilda Wanner remembering her husband, Sebastian, at a workshop sponsored by Project Unpack. And she was unpacking a bit, literally, actually. She brought a bag of things with her, but mentally as well. And that's what Project Unpack is about. You can find out more by going to unpackstories.org, the Project Unpack website, or by continuing to listen, because we've got more stories to come today from this workshop that we're bringing you to here on Prairie Public. And by the way, you'll be able to hear this program again at prairiepublic.org. This workshop was at the Riverview Senior Living Facility in Fargo. People came and were presented with soft porcelain cups, not fired yet, that they could inscribe or press letters into or press different things into. And some of the things they brought were pretty interesting. We've got more stories to come for you here as we're learning more about the experience of war, military service, and its effect on people and their families. Project Unpack. As I wandered around the room with my microphone, I saw one man who was just sitting quietly back against the wall. He later told me he was hard of hearing and was having a hard time figuring out what was going on. Went over and sat down to talk to him. So are you going to make one of those pots, one of those cups?
There's a lot of talking going on.
Yeah. So are you going to make one of those cups?
I don't know.
I think they want you to, probably.
Yeah. So. I think that's why I'm here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Try the back side.
I think it's a good idea. They're getting some older people to talk about World War II and prior to that and that stuff. I think that's an excellent idea. Mm-hmm. Put all of this down on tape for people that are 100 years from now will all know what the hell happened to us people.
Well, and I think these cups, the idea of these cups is, you know, that they'll last for a long time.
Yeah. I think it's a really good idea. It's a good idea. I think we should put on tape or on paper what has happened to us 50, 60, 100 years ago. Yeah. Because if we don't put this stuff down where people can read it or see it, it's going to die. And that'd be a shame. Yeah. Really would be a shame.
Tell me your name.
Henry Labore, L-A-B-O-R-E.
And what's your connection with the service?
Well, I joined the Minnesota Air National Guard when I was 17 with permission. And the Minnesota Guard went to Louisiana for training. And then the war broke out and all hell broke loose.
Oh, yeah. This one, if we haven't been there,
but that's that's a long time ago already. It's hard to realize that, you know, it's 60, 70 years ago. Man, that's a lifetime.
Yeah.
A lot of people don't live to be 90 or 100. And I'll be 100 in just a few more years. I'm very fortunate.
Wow.
Very fortunate. I had a good upbringing. And I had an excellent wife who was a good cook.
Yeah, keeps you healthy, huh?
Oh yeah, and full. I've had a very, very good life. If I had to do it over again, I would. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
I don't think I'd change anything.
So after the war started, where did you end up going?
Where did I? I was born and raised in St. Paul on the east side by Lake Phelan. Grew up there, went to high school there, and then the war broke out. I was a member of the Minnesota Air National Guard. War broke out, and most of us in the 109th didn't stay. We had enough experience that they used us for other things. And it was a good experience.
So what did you end up doing?
Flying in a B-17, teaching. I wasn't a pilot, I was a bombardier navigator. And trying to teach young people, 18, 19, 20 years old, the intricacies of being a bombardier was a big job. They could not really grab that you lay on your belly and you release all those bombs. It was different. Yeah, it was different.
Did you like B-17s?
Absolutely. Best airplane in World War II. The Flying Fortress.
I was going to say on the way here.
There was a gunner in the nose. There was a gunner on both sides. There was a gunner in the tail. And the pilot and co-pilot had machine gun activities right in front of them that they could use. There was 2, 4, 6, 8. There was 10 P-50s machine guns in one airplane. When you put 100 airplanes with all that much armor, man, you're throwing bullets out of there by the thousands. Yeah.
So, were you married when you went in?
I wasn't, but I got married during service.
During service, huh?
Yeah. My wife died about 5 years ago.
And how was it, how do you think it was for her being married to a serviceman?
Well, I was a serviceman about 5 years while we married, and then the war ended and I got out of the military.
Uh-huh.
But she wasn't crazy about the military at all, not at all.
So was she with you or did she stay?
She came to be with me whenever she could. A lot of the bases I were on didn't want visitors. So she came when she could. And long time ago.
How was it for your parents?
How was it?
For your parents, what did they think of all this?
Well, my dad especially thought the whole damn thing was just almost a joke to him. But it wasn't. He finally did realize that men and women were being killed. And that hit him hard. It hit him real hard. He died when he was 92. My mother was 98.
There's a lot of this kind of going.
And I'll be 94, so I'm trying to reach 100. It might happen.
Yeah, you look in good shape.
Yeah.
Okay, so. You love it. Good. So what we will do is...
So what did your mother think of you being in the Air Force?
She didn't like it. She didn't like the military at all. Most mothers and most women didn't care for the military because it was military. What the military unit did might be different, might be something that they could appreciate, but it's because of military. The military had a feeling, the civilians had a feeling that all the military was is to kill people. Well, that wasn't true. Yes, killing people was prime, but that wasn't the only thing the military did. They mopped up. They cured. They helped the soldiers that were wounded. They did all kinds of things. Amazing. It really was. You could... Well, they took me from Fargo to San Francisco, San Francisco to Hawaii, and Hawaii to a little tiny island. Didn't even have a name. Way in the southern part of the Pacific. And I was there for 6 months, and from there we went on our missions. Some of the missions were long. We were in the air for 8 to 10 years, or 10 hours at a time. It's a long time.
Yeah.
Good pilots, bad pilots, in between pilots.
So what do you think you might do with your cup here? They have, like, you can press letters into them, or...
I would like to turn it upside down and have my name printed and date, and then I want to give it to my oldest daughter, and when she dies, to the next one. I have 9 children, so that'll take care of that for a long time. It'll stay in the family, period. Go from my kids to grandkids to great-grandkids all the way down the line. I hope 100 years from now somebody can see. Yeah.
Well, these ceramic cups, they hold up really well.
Well, if you take care of something like that, it'll last forever. It'll last forever. And if I get one of those and it comes into my family, I will write my story on that cup and put it along with the cup on the inside and say that anybody that has this cup does not destroy the little information I put in there. This is part of the cup. And I think they'll do that. Yeah, I think they'll do that. But it's... World War II was a long time ago, but now that I'm talking about it, it wasn't so long ago for me.
My come back.
Oh my.
Mr. Labor has brought a bag of things from his room at the Riverview Senior Living Facility with him. Looking through them is spurring some memories.
Something like that, or that?
Well, I haven't looked at this or any of this stuff for a long time. I've got a lot of stuff in here. I got stuff upstairs in my, but I don't look at it very often. I don't have reason to look at it very often. But when I do, it brings back memories that some are good, but most of them are not so good. You know, you're in the front end of that B-17 and you're 50 feet above the ground going 250 miles an hour. Boy, the ground is going by so fast you can't recognize it. One little mistake, boom, you're dead. The whole crew. And that happens often. It did happen often. You know, we went to pilot training, and you went through pilot training, and you're qualified. That doesn't mean you're a good pilot. You have no experience. They put you in the airplane. There's a bombardier and a navigator and a gunner and a gunner and a gunner, and you have the responsibility for every one of those lives. And they put a 19-year-old kid driving that airplane. Shit. You can just guess the things that might happen.
Yeah.
And you know, they had pilots 20, 25, maybe 26, but they had the young people coming into the program. Although the 25-year-olds were all taken already, now they went down to 22, 20. You can imagine a number one pilot in a B-17 with a load of bombs, and I'm only 19 years old, crying out loud. We can talk about it, but there's no way that you can really understand the pressure on that pilot at that age with a whole crew and a whole belly full of bombs. God.
Wow.
I haven't said these words for... Take good care of them.
Okay. Yes,
thanks.
Henry Labor. Well, people are continuing to unpack here at the Project Unpack workshop with the ceramic cups and a lot of stories. One man I walk up to has brought something I don't recognize at all. It's a little short piece of metal, like an inch long, a little shiny piece of metal, with a flange, kind of like a shark's fin, coming off on one side.
Wow, that would be perfect.
Everybody that's ever been in the military had one of those to open. It was eating. We had the happy food.
In a variety of ways.
Yeah, I remember those from when I was
listening to the stories of Ed.
But
I've carried this one though since Korea.
I fit both of those.
Yes, you did.
Brought it back with me.
We're doing some.
Is pushing it against the clay, and from the inside I'm just sort of moving my hand around it, and I'm going to be making the impression. So I'll do a quick test and I'll show you what the face looks like.
Artist and veteran Josh Zeiss takes the strange little metal object and starts making impressions in one of the soft ceramic cups.
There's a space in there.
That's great.
So
no, I was just, how do you?
So go on and use it however you want on this cup.
I don't even know how I'd start. This is I brought this back from Korea with me.
What is it?
This is a can opener, GI can opener.
Okay. Here's a thought.
Yeah.
How about? I don't know how it works, but you can use that. You can actually use it around the rim and use it as a detail.
Well, no, you actually use it like this. You see, that part goes into the lid of the can,
yeah.
And you go like this, and you go around it like that.
Can you do that around the whole rim?
Well, on there, I don't. I suppose you could,
just
but
just so that it leaves a texture. I'm interested in that.
Huh? Do you remember these? You remember the old GI can opener? Yeah.
Oh, yeah, you brought the can opener.
Yeah, he's going to go around the rim. He's going around the rim on this one. This is going to be great. The texture.
I'll let you do it. I mean, I'm too.
Okay, you got to walk me through it because I'm not exactly
well,
sure.
Well, just think of it as a can opener where you go like this.
You will. Polished.
Yeah. Weathered.
My eyesight isn't worth a damn. But they're very simple. I mean, it's really simple.
You're going to teach me.
All right. So
on the bulletin board, there's a different thing. Yeah, so it's like completely.
I'm going to. You'd be surprised if you hit a can here.
What are you
going to
do?
This is great.
Where
am I
going to
go?
Because of that.
Well, I left them happily making marks on the clay cup with the old GI can opener and wandered over to a group, as a family group centered around John McClain, and they were talking a lot about a particular North Dakota National Guard unit and its reputation, the 164th.
I don't know if I met you. I'm Bill Thomas from Prairie Public, and I'm trying to do a radio story about this. So.
Hmm. Your name is?
My name is John McClain.
He couldn't get to just one, so he made it for everybody.
We never saw that, Doug, until Dad died.
No, you were telling me that.
We got it, and Jim and Jeannie, I got most of his military stuff because it's going to be passed on to Mike. But Jim and Jeannie each got Japanese daggers, officer daggers. But Dad never showed it to us his whole life. It was always kept in a box.
Your finger, it'll go through.
So if you put your the picture I saw. You should see the picture of when he was like 21 or 22 years old, and he was a sniper on Guadalcanal. My dad was, and they
call it a dime a dozen
club, and it's sort of like the graveyard humor you have when you're out there, and theoretically you got a dime for every 12 kills registered kills you got.
But I'm gonna put a little line in
all of these baby-faced young men, and just when I read the official army history of Guadalcanal,
so if you put that in,
they just amaze me.
This way. Here, I'll stamp the aim.
Yes.
And then I'll have you do the other ones.
It's crazy because I've spoken to my dad, and like he's like 18 years old. I can't even imagine.
When you look at the history of North Dakota, the first army unit to see battle on an offensive type was on Guadalcanal, and that was the 164th National Guard unit.
Well, the 164th goes back, actually, you know, to history in the Philippines.
Yeah.
And there's a flag, a unit flag somewhere that says they couldn't stampede the first North Dakota, and that came from when they attempted to drive cattle or something against the lines, and they didn't because they were dug in. It's an interesting story.
164th has got a history that, you know, a lot of regular Army units would be proud of. And when you read, I went to the, when Mike was, one of the schools Mike went to was, instead of going to the captain's course in the Army, he was selected to go to the ground warfare school at Quantico, and they had Army officers, Marine officers, and then international officers come over to take that course. And anyway, when I was there, I went to the Marine Museum, which is fascinating. It is that's a must-see if you ever go to Washington, D.C., just south.
Enlisted in the Guard. These guys had just come back. I was a kid during the Second World War. In 1947, I enlisted in the National Guard because they had reactivated the Guard then. So I enlisted as a buck private. My folks had to sign for me because I was still a senior in high school,
right,
you know.
Too young.
So, and then I spent, well, in and out of the Guard for 28 years. So when I finally retired, like John, we retired from the Guard. But,
when Mike was there at that museum, I went in and they had a bunch of retired, very elderly Marine there, some of them officers, some of them gunnies, and I was looking around, especially at the World War II stuff, and the guy said, did your dad serve? And I said, yeah, he was with the 164th.
And then B?
He lit up and he says, oh, you mean the Honorary Marine Unit?
That's right.
The courage, the ability of those guys, the Fargo Band Unit, those guys. supposedly, according to this book, before World War I, the guys in the band in the North Dakota National Guard, they got, you know, they went and fought World War I in the trenches, too. I mean, every time there was a World War, there was North Dakotans at the front. But the band, not being trained riflemen, ended up being stretcher bearers. Well, that's dangerous as heck, because you had to pick the guys out of the trenches and haul them back carrying a stretcher to the ambulances, and people could shoot at you. So after World War I, they had a tough time getting people back into the band. And then they started promising, well, we won't make you stretcher bearers anymore. Well, yeah, they gave him a rifle and said, this time you get to be an infantry.
So I was in North Dakota National.
The 164th. This is Prairie Public. I'm Bill Thomas, and I'm trying to bring you around to a Project Unpack workshop. This is a workshop where people take clay cups and make designs in them, press letters into them to help
unpack memories about being a veteran or being part of a veteran's family. And some of the memories don't have to do with actual fighting and being at war. Being a surgical technician made quite an impression on the next person I spoke with.
Okay. So were you in the service?
Yeah, I was, yeah. World War II.
Uh-huh.
And I was in Guam for two and a half years.
Mm-hmm.
And I was a medical surgical assistant. And in 204th General Hospital.
Uh-huh.
And I assisted oral surgeon on wounds of the face, neck, and head, and mostly in surgical and care after surgery.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You must have been young to be doing that type of work.
I was in the early 20s, yeah, yeah. And yeah, it was an experience that would, it was very difficult because it was so terrible.
Mm-hmm.
And we try and keep those guys alive as much as possible.
And what was so terrible was just how much they were.
Well, yeah, it was so many wounded, you know. And facial wounds are terrible because you can't do much about that. And it was kind of bad. And then we worked when Iwo Jima took place. Most of the wounded came down to Guam where we were in our hospital. And there were so many wounded that they were in the hallway and everything. You know, it was just awful. And we worked about 2 days in a row.
Wow, working long hours.
Yeah. Trying to keep them alive, you know. Some of them were bleeding through the cot that we put them on, and doctors couldn't get to them in time. It was awful. It was a wonderful experience that way. And the oral surgeon was a major from Detroit, Michigan. And he had his office in the Fisher Building there in Detroit. And he was the only oral surgeon that we had there. So he was a pretty busy guy. Along with him was a plastic surgeon who had two people helping him. So there was five of us all together. And plastic surgeon did some marvelous things. And well, both of them did, yeah. So that was what is going on. The temperature at Guam is about 87 degrees average. And it rained a lot. It rained so much we just forgot about the rain, you know. And the humidity was very high. There was a few Japanese back in the jungle at that time. And we had a squad of riflemen that went out after them. But it was a big, big operation. All kinds of stuff. A lot of burns from crashed airplanes. And B-29 was pretty popular at that time.
Was that the most common injury? Burns?
Well, a lot of times, if a plane crashed, it would usually be on fire, that was a lot of the wounds that were. Some of them, of course, didn't make it. And I did work in the morgue one time, it was quite an experience. When I first came there, they were just building the hospital, and the hospital wasn't quite done yet. And we slept where we could, and the Seabees were working hard to build a hospital for us. And the Japanese were still kind of active there at that time, but this was in 1944, 45, and part of 46. And when the Japanese surrendered, they shipped me back to Hawaii, and I went to an army university there for a while before they found a place for me to be discharged. And that's about it, yeah.
So this may seem like a funny question, but did it change your life, having that?
No, it didn't. In a way it did, because I came back to Fargo, and I decided to take medical training at NDSU. And I was there for 2 years and realized that this was not for me. So I looked for a job, and I found a job with the Burroughs Corporation, with business machines. And that's who I stuck with for 36 years. Yeah, so I wish I could have finished, because I wanted to be a oral surgeon too. But my background in some of the subjects wasn't good enough for that. But it was really some experience. We never had anybody shooting at us, or we didn't shoot at anybody. We were just medical people, and that was fine with me. Yeah, I, at least I thought I was doing something good, you know.
This is Bill Thomas at Prairie Public, and we've been hearing from a Project Unpack workshop about veterans and their stories and objects that they make that help unlock the stories. You can find more about Project Unpack at unpackstories.org, and you can hear this program again anytime by going to prairiepublic.org. Some of the people that we heard here: Hilda Warner, Doug Odegaard, Henry Labor, Ronald Caselin, Art Carlson, John Conlon, John McClain, and Josh Zeiss, and Michael Strand, who were workshop leaders, and Christina Weber, who leads the whole project for NDSU. It's sponsored by the National Endowment for the Humanities. I remember when I was a kid going up in the attic and finding my father's Purple Heart. So when I heard them talking about pressing a Purple Heart into a clay cup to make an impression, I went to listen to that.
So, with a Purple Heart, if you tell me, where you would like this on the cup, and then what I'm going to do is help you do that, because with a Purple Heart, I want to be very careful. One, for the object, and two, for the cup, so it doesn't crack it. So if you tell me where, I still see it like you are doing it, and I'm helping. Right in the center? So let me, is it okay if I hold this?
Yes.
So what I'm going to do, because I see this as incredibly precious, I'm going to...
That links with the radio. Can I sit by you?
Yeah, what will happen is when the Purple Heart will be accentuated, so you'll see all the lines. Should we do it on four sides, or do you want to do it once?
Whichever way.
Yeah, what do you...
I don't want you to break your...
I think the cup will be fine. I'm just being... So you can see...
Oh, but he has a...
It's beautiful. And then we'll do two more sides. I didn't know we'd have a Purple Heart.
Toward the end of the workshop, I asked Michael Strand, did this work make him feel more pro-military or anti-military? Or I'll give him the last word.
From my perspective, it's just, it's revealing the humanity of what it means to serve. It's not pro, against, for, it's simply about dialogue, and what's shared is remarkable.